Good evening. If you have your Bibles, I'd invite you to turn to the book of 1 Corinthians, chapter 11. We're going to be looking at verses 2 through 16 of 1 Corinthians 11. We've been having some lessons on Sunday nights, as you know, talking about various lifestyle issues of the Christian faith. We've had as our theme the idea of pleasing God. Out of a love for Him, we desire to please Him. And He's given us certain directions concerning how we're to live, and we want to follow after those things. Tonight is a little bit different. I've invited Steve and Connie to help me out. Rather than simply doing a lecture style or a teaching style, we're going to do a conversation style. And the background of this is a pastor who has a new convert couple in his church. And they've been coming to his office for discipleship classes. And so we're going to pick up a session of their discipleship tonight. And they're going to help me read the different parts. And we're going to be working our way through 1 Corinthians 11 as we do this. So we'll start. And the pastor asks Steve and Nancy, he says, "Well, any questions before we start today's lesson?"
"I have one. But it's not about what we've been studying."
"No problem. What's on your mind?"
"Well, ever since Steve and I started attending church here, I've noticed that most of the women don't cut their hair. And at first I thought it was a coincidence, but now I'm curious. Is there some reason why the women don't cut their hair?"
"Well, I'm glad you asked. This is a good opportunity to teach you guys about the authority structure of the church."
"My question was about hair, and you said we're going to talk about authority. Do I have that right?"
"Yes. Yes, you do. I want you guys to turn to the book of 1 Corinthians in the New Testament, and I'm going to show you. This is Paul's first letter to the Corinthians. And in this particular letter, Paul is dealing with several issues that had created division within the church. And he answered some questions that the Corinthians had sent him. The section we're going to be looking at together, chapter 11, is found after Paul's reply to a question about meat offered to idols. And we're going to start our reading with verse 2, 1 Corinthians 11, 2. I'll be reading from the New American Standard. "Now I praise you because you remember me in everything and hold firmly to the traditions just as I delivered them to you." So you'll notice here in this verse that Paul begins by praising the Corinthians. This is typical of Paul. He often used praise to soften some of the criticism that would come afterwards. The phrase there, "you remember me in everything," means that whenever a problem came up, they thought of Paul, who had lived there with them, and they did their best to remember what he had taught them.
So what does Paul mean by the word traditions? Is he talking about cultural traditions?
That's a good question. It's important to understand what Paul means by this word. The word that is translated here, traditions, in the Greek is paradosis. And in this context, it's referring to Paul's oral and written teachings. And anytime Paul uses this term in the New Testament in reference to his own teaching, it refers not to cultural traditions or customs, but to the divine revelation that God had communicated through him. If you turn over to Galatians and you look at chapter 1, you'll notice that Paul says this about what he taught. He said, "For I would have you to know, brethren, that the gospel which was preached by me is not according to man. I neither received it from man, nor was I taught it, but I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ." So it's clear that Paul did not consider himself to be teaching traditions of man. He only preached what was revealed to him by God. Paul also commanded the Thessalonians to exercise church discipline on those who refused to abide by the, and the word again is tradition, that he had given them.
So what Paul meant when he said paradosis is not what we normally mean when we say traditions?
Exactly. Now we're going to move on to verse 3. After Paul praises the Corinthians for their obedience, he introduces the main theme of this section, and that is the authority structure of the church, as I mentioned before. Verse 3 says, "But I want you to understand that Christ is the head of every man, and the man is the head of a woman, and God is the head of Christ.
What do you mean by the word head?
Well, in this context, the word head means authority over. When you are the head of something, you exercise authority over those that are under you. So the people that you lead or guide would be submitting to you, and they would accept your leadership.
What's the significance of God being the head of Christ? Does that affect their equality?
No. Keep in mind that the roles of Father, Son, and Spirit merely represent the different offices and functions that exist within the Trinity. God, in His person of Father, has authority over God the Son. But this in no way detracts from the essential divinity of each person.
So, when Jesus was here on earth, even though He was God, He was under the authority of the Father, right?
That's right. For example, you could look at John 5, verse 30, and it says, Jesus is talking and He says, I can do nothing on my own initiative. As I hear, I judge, and my judgment is just because I do not seek my own will, but the will of Him who sent me. So throughout the Gospels, you'll notice that His entire ministry, Jesus was submitting Himself to the Father's headship. If you have some time this week, you guys might want to look up John chapter 4, verse 34, and John 6, verse 38. Now, I want you to note the authority structure that we have here in verse 3. At the top, we've got the Father's authority over the Son. Under the Son is man, and under the man is woman.
Nancy, did you hear that? The wife is to submit to her husband.
No, sorry. This passage isn't talking about a husband and wife relationship.
It's not? How so?
Well, the word man in verse 3 is aner, and it refers specifically to males. And although it can mean both man and husband, the normal use of this term is man. Look at the very first part of verse 3 again and notice that he uses the word every. He says every man.
I see what you mean. This is talking about all men, not just husbands.
That's right. If we take out the word man there in verse 3 and we put in the word husband, then anyone who's single is excluded. So that doesn't make sense contextually in what he's saying. So you notice verse 4 is the same way.
Yes, you can apply the same logic to verse 5. Instead of every man, it's every woman. And if we put in wife, the same thing happens.
Correct. Continue looking on down through the verses at verses 7 through 11. Paul talks about the creation of man and woman. And again, he's stressing the idea of men and women in general, not just husband and wives.
The word husband makes sense, or less sense here than it did earlier. Verses 8 and 9 especially.
Verses 13 through 16 are the same way. Paul again is making some observations from nature. And once again, he's talking here about men and women in general. So, all right, we've covered a lot of ground here. What I want to do now is let's just have a quick review before we go on to verse 4. I'm just going to draw this out for you. And the pastor draws a picture. He's got a picture here of a church building. At the top, we've got God. Under God is Christ. Under Christ is man. And under man is woman. So, context, local church. And this is the authority structure that exists within the local church. God has authority over Christ. Christ has authority over the church. Both men and women submit to Christ and obey Him. And within the church, man has authority over the woman. Part of a woman's submission to Christ is her submission to the man.
So this means that I have to submit to every Tom, Dick, and Harry.
No. The context here, Nancy, is the local church.
Okay.
The woman is to come under the man's authority within that specific setting. And so what you see is they are not to take positions of power or authority that God specifically designed for men to fill. Paul's letters to Timothy, for example, deal with a lot of these different roles in the church. Maybe next week in our lesson we can go over some of those. All right, let's move on now to go back to 1 Corinthians 11. We're going to be returning to verses 4 and 5 now. I'll continue to read here for you. Every man who has something on his head while praying or prophesying disgraces his head. But every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, for she is one and the same with her whose head is shaved. Now you notice in verse 4, Paul introduces another meaning of that word head. We talked about the first meaning was authority over. Now he adds the meaning physical head, as in the top of your head. The head in these verses that is covered or uncovered is this physical head, while the head that is dishonored is your authoritative head, that is Christ or the man. So the authoritative head of the man is Christ. The authoritative head of the woman is the man.
What does Paul mean when he says something on his head and her head uncovered?
It must be referring to a material covering of some sort, probably a veil or something.
It certainly seems that way at first glance, but let's take a closer look and see if you're correct.
What else could it be?
Well, it's obvious that if a person's head is covered, then there's something that is covering it, right? Okay, so that makes sense. But if you look at verses 4 and 5, there is nothing in the context of these verses that tells you exactly what the covering is. If you take a closer look at those two phrases, something on his head and her head uncovered, the first one, kata kephales ekhon, literally reads, down head having. And the second phrase, atakata kaluptos te kephal, literally reads, uncovered with the head. You can see that the words themselves are giving no indication of what the nature of the covering is. And although it's natural to think of a covering as a material object of some kind, like a veil, we have no way of determining that simply from these two verses here, 4 and 5.
Well, how do you determine what the covering is?
Well, we're going to have to move out of verses 4 and 5 into the larger context. As you guys know, words have many different meanings, and we depend on the context in which a word is used to point us to the meaning that makes the most sense. For example, the word trunk. You can use that word to be talking about a large chest that you would use to pack things in. Trunk could be used to talk about the main stem of a tree. Or you could be talking about the trunk of your car, which is the rear part of your car. Now, if I said to you, Nancy, please get the trunk down from the attic, the context of the sentence indicates that I'm talking about a chest, not a tree or a car, right? So in our cases here in 1 Corinthians 11, 4 and 5, the verses haven't given us enough information to determine exactly what he means. So we're going to examine the verses following to see if we can get a conclusion here. So start with verse 6 and read on down to verse 16 and try to determine from the context of these verses what the covering is. So in the story here, Nancy and Steve read on through the verses, and after a moment, Steve looks up and says,
I think I found it. The last part of verse 15 says, for her hair is given to her for a covering.
Excellent. You'll see here that verse 15 provides us with a contextual indication of the nature of the covering. You notice the ending phrase, for a covering there in verse 15. The word for is anti, and in this context means instead of or in place of. And the word covering is parabaleo, and refers to a mantle or a material covering. So Paul's point in verse 15 is, a woman's hair has been given to her in the place of a material covering. So the hair that's on your head actually is the covering that Paul is talking about.
I'm still confused. If hair is the covering, then what makes a person's head covered or uncovered?
All right, good question. Read verses 14 and 15 again. What word does Paul use to describe the hair? And I'll read for you 1 Corinthians 11:14-15. Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it is a dishonor to him, but if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given to her for a covering.
I see. Long hair. That must mean that a man's head is covered if his hair is long, and a woman's head is uncovered if her hair is short.
That is correct. Okay, so let's review what we've just been talking about. We determined from the context. We looked at verses 4 and 5. We were confused. We weren't sure what covering he was talking about. The context showed us that the covering is hair. So 4, 5, 14, and 15 show us that hair serves as a covering. If a man has long hair, then his physical head is covered, and he dishonors his authoritative head, Christ. If a woman has short hair, then her physical head is uncovered, and she dishonors her authoritative head, the man.
What's the significance of dishonoring your authoritative head?
Well, think back to the authority structure that we talked about in verse 3. So we've got God is the head of Christ. Christ is the head of man is the head of woman. Verses 4 and 5 show us how this authority structure is visibly represented in the local church body. When a man has short hair, he honors his authoritative head, Christ. In the same way, when a woman has long hair, she honors her authoritative head, the man. So from this relationship that we see here, it's clear that hair is a kind of symbol of submission. Short hair symbolizes the man's submission to Christ. Long hair symbolizes the woman's submission to the man and through him to Christ. When a man has long hair or a woman has short hair, they shame Jesus Christ and violate 1 Corinthians 10:31, which tells us that we're to do everything to the glory of God.
So that's why you said my question was a good opportunity
Yes.
to teach us about the authority structure of the church. I see how it all fits together. Now, this is fascinating.
Wait a minute. There's still a problem, though, with all of this. How long is long hair? How short is short hair? Who's to say what's long and what's short when it's different for everyone?
Oh, that's a fair question. I asked myself the same thing when I studied this passage. My first step to come to an answer to that is to examine the word hair. The Greek word is kome, and I was looking at that word in the last part of verse 15. So I did a word study of its use in the New Testament, and I discovered that it's only used twice. Now, I also went ahead and investigated its use in the Septuagint and in first century Greek literature.
What's the Septuagint?
Okay. The Septuagint is a Greek translation of the Old Testament. So the Old Testament is written originally in Hebrew and Aramaic. And around the 2nd century BC, a group of Jewish scholars was commissioned to translate it from Hebrew and Aramaic into Greek. And we refer to that translation of the Old Testament into Greek as the Septuagint. And it's a great source of information about the common Greek of that period. You can compare the Hebrew to the Greek.
How is it helpful in word studies?
Well, think back to our illustration with the word trunk. Suppose I said something like, get the spare tire out of the trunk. If you didn't know what the word trunk meant, you could tell just from the context of the sentence that it had something to do with the vehicle, right? And if a little later on I said to you, hey, nail this sign to the trunk of that tree,
I'd realize that trunk had more than one meaning. And the more you use the word, the better idea I would have of its original or its various meanings.
That's right. That's right. The word, the Greek word for hair, kome, is used 11 times in the Septuagint. And by studying its usage there, as well as its usage in first century Greek literature, I gained an understanding of its various meanings.
So what did you learn?
Well, I found out that the word kome could refer to hair, either a man's or a woman's, long or feminine length hair, or uncut hair. So what I did next was to determine, okay, I've got these meanings of the word. Which meaning now makes the most sense in the context of 1 Corinthians 11? So let's go back now to verses 5 and 6 and read these. But every woman who has her head uncovered while praying or prophesying disgraces her head, her authoritative head. For she is one and the same as the woman whose head is shaved. For if a woman does not cover her head, that is her physical head, let her also have her hair cut off. But if it is disgraceful for a woman to have her hair cut off or her head shaved, let her cover her head. All right, so the last section of verse 5 tells us that in God's eyes, a woman who has short hair is the same as a woman whose head is shaved. And then verse 6 continues that thought by adding that since it's a shame for a woman to have a shaved head, she should have long hair.
What's the difference between cut off and shaved in verse 6?
Okay, so the two words there are synonyms. Cut off, kero, means to cut short. It occurs four times in the New Testament, twice right here in verse 6, once in reference to Paul cutting off his hair, Acts 18:18, and once when speaking of a shearer of sheep, Acts 8:32. It's used a lot more in the Septuagint, again, typically in reference to shearing a sheep, and its normal meaning would be to cut very short. The word shave, zuru, means to shave with a razor. So it occurs three times in the New Testament, once here in verse 5, once in verse 6, and once in Acts 21:24. Again, it's used more frequently in Septuagint, usually in reference to actually shaving off a person's hair or beard with a razor.
So what's the connection between uncovered, cut off, and shaved?
Okay, so here's the progression. Zuru, which is shaved, refers to shaving off the hair completely, nothing left on the head. Kero, which is cut off, refers to just cutting it very short, like you would crop the hair short. And Atacalupto, uncovered, refers to any cutting of the hair that's less than kero. So, okay, we've gone through all these Greek words. What does this all mean? Boil it down. Paul is saying that a woman who cuts her hair is the same as a woman who crops it short or shaves her head. Both of those things are shameful.
Well, I can see now which definition of komi makes the most sense in this passage. A woman's covering is her long or uncut hair. If she cuts her hair, then she becomes uncovered and brings dishonor to the man on the man.
Right. So, Steve, this answers your question that you were asking about how long is long and how short is short, right? Long hair is uncut hair. Short hair is cut hair. A man's cut hair visibly shows his submission to Christ, and a woman's uncut hair visibly shows her submission to the man and through him to Christ. You'll notice we're going to continue reading in verse 7, and it completes this train of thought. It says, "For a man ought not to have his head covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of man."
This is what you were telling us earlier about dishonoring your head. God's glory is at stake.
Yes. And this verse also supports our contextual understanding of the covering as long uncut hair and not a material covering.
How so?
Well, man was created in the image and glory of God. So that is something that has been true of him since creation. Yet, we find in the Old Testament that God commanded the priests to wear on top of their physical heads a cloth head covering as they ministered before the Lord. If verse 7 is teaching that a man should not wear a material head covering because man is the glory of God, then it stands to reason that the priests in the Old Testament should not have worn them either. Since God required his priests to wear head coverings, it makes sense here that Paul is referring to something other than an actual material head covering.
That makes sense. I think I'm starting to understand what Paul is getting at here. Man is the glory of God, and what man does brings honor or dishonor to God.
Yes. So the theme of glory and shame is woven throughout Paul's entire discussion here in chapter 11. Notice this last part of verse 7. The woman is the glory of the man. What the woman does brings honor or dishonor to the man.
There's one thing that bothers me. Why did God put women under the authority of men?
Well, I can certainly understand why you would ask that question. I think a lot of other women have also wondered about that. But if we continue reading, I think it'll become clearer because Paul actually discusses this in the next few verses. Let's go ahead and read chapter 11, verses 8, 9, and 10. For man does not originate from woman, but woman from man. For indeed man was not created for the woman's sake, but woman for the man's sake. Therefore, the woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. So you see in verse 8, it explains how the woman is the glory of the man and why the man is given the position of authority. The woman was made from the man and she brings glory to him. She's under his authority because he was created before her and she was created from his body.
Verse 9 gives a second reason for man's headship. The woman was made specifically for the man. She was designed to be his helper and to accept his leadership.
That is correct.
I understand what you're saying, but this certainly wouldn't go over very well with most of my friends. I even have a hard time accepting it, and I guess I'm just used to thinking that men and women are equal before God.
They are equal before God. I don't want you to misunderstand that. Equality is not the issue here in chapter 11. Authority is the issue. Mm-hmm. Remember Steve's question about God being the head of Christ and whether that, you know, was talking about equality. God the Father has authority over God the Son. But both the Son and the Father are equal. They're both equally God. Paul is not saying that women are inferior to men. He's simply saying that woman is under the man's authority within the church. In fact, he goes on here in verses 11 and 12 to emphasize that both men and women are dependent on each other within the body of Christ. No part of the body functions properly without the other parts of the body. Let's read verses 11 and 12. However, in the Lord, neither is woman independent of man, nor is man independent of woman. For as the woman originates from the man, so also the man has his birth through the woman. And all things originate from God.
I see. Verse 12 means that just as the woman needed the man to begin her existence, so the man needs the woman to continue his existence. And both the man and the woman have God as their ultimate source.
Yes. The truth that men and women need each other and are dependent on each other balances the truth that women are under man's authority. So we come now in the verses to Paul's concluding statements. In verse 13, he comes back to his main theme by asking the Corinthians to use their common sense about the difference between a man's hair and a woman's hair. Picking back up in verse 13, he says, "Judge for yourselves. Is it proper for a woman to pray to God with her head uncovered?" That is, with cut hair. "Does not even nature itself teach you that if a man has long hair, it's a dishonor to him? But if a woman has long hair, it is a glory to her. For her hair is given to her for a covering."
It seems to me that he's pointing out that long hair is naturally thought of as womanly or feminine. If a man lets his hair grow long, it is generally thought to be unnatural and shameful. Most men want to be seen as manly, not womanly, so they keep their hair cut.
Right. And what does Paul say that a woman's hair is?
He says it is her glory. I see the connection. The glory of the man is the woman, and the glory of the woman is her long or uncut hair.
Exactly. So Paul wants us to realize that even the very natural order of things, just the way men and women are naturally, women have long hair, men have shorter hair. That's not to say that there aren't some men whose hair is long, but but that the normal course of men and women is men have the shorter hair, women have long hair. He concludes his discussion with verse 16. Again, he says, but if one is inclined to be contentious, we have no other practice, nor have the churches of God. Now you notice in verse 16 here, Paul's beginning words, but if one is inclined to be contentious, show that he expected opposition to what he was saying, right? The word contentious here indicates a person who loves strife. It's someone who battles over the meaning of words and likes to prolong an argument. Notice how Paul deals with this kind of a person. He says, his teaching on this matter is followed by all the churches of God. There is no other practice or way of dealing with this issue apart from his instruction.
So, this is a basic principle that applies to everyone, not just the Corinthians?
That's right. See, the whole focus of 1 Corinthians 11 is, again, the authority structure of the church. And so, obviously, that means it's still true for you and I today.
So much for my trip to the beauty salon this afternoon.
Just think of the money we'll save.
Now, I want you to know, Nancy, that caring for long, uncut hair isn't always easy. And why don't you just talk to my wife? She'll be glad to show you how to care for and style your hair tastefully.
Thank you.
Before you go, let's just kind of review what we've learned, and you can use your notes if you need to. First off, what is the theme of the passage?
The authority structure of the church. God has authority over Christ. Christ has authority over the man. And the man has authority over the woman.
And what's the context of this authority structure?
The local church. Women are to submit to the leadership of the man within the church. They should not take positions of authority that God designed for the man to fill.
And what is the visible symbol of the man and woman's submission?
Their hair. Man should keep his hair cut. The woman should leave her hair uncut.
And if they violate this command, what does that mean?
They shame their authoritative head. The man dishonors Christ and the woman dishonors the man.
Why does that happen?
Well, because man is the glory of God and woman is the glory of the man. And when they disobey God, they bring shame to themselves and reflect that shame unto the person they should glorify.
And what reasons does Paul give for men being an authority over women?
Well, the first is man's priority in creation. The woman was made from the man. The second was that the woman was made to be man's helper. She was made for him.
And how does Paul balance out this truth of men being an authority over women?
He goes on to say that men and women need each other and depend on each other. Woman was created for man, but man needs the woman to continue his existence.
And is all of this relevant for us today?
Yes, I see that it is. Verse 16 makes it clear that this was not just for the Corinthians. The authority structure of the church and its visible representation through our hair is just as true for us as it was for them.
Fantastic. You guys are great students. I really appreciate your interest as we work through these verses. Let's have a word of prayer before you go. All right, thank you. Let's give Steve and Connie a round of applause. They did a great job. Thank you very much for that.
So do you want to go back and Deborah and she ad-libbed on every Tom, Dick, and Harry. I think that was
Yeah, I'm going to leave that in the recording.